The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, 2019 Special Awards Report, Women in Business. From a list of 200-plus nominations from Triangle Area Business Executives, judges picked 26 exceptional winners this year. These winners represent some 11 distinct industries, from commercial real estate to law to finance, and for most of them, the journey is just beginning. And from this collection of stories, we'll read the Lifetime Achievement winner. The headline, Personable and Driven, Yao Makes Mark at NC State. And this is written by Dane Huffman. Debbie Yao became the first woman to lead an athletics department in the Atlantic Coast Conference when she was hired by the University of Maryland in 1994. Her sister Kay was the head women's basketball coach at NC State University, and the two talked often. The Yaos grew up in the small North Carolina town of Gibsonville, and Debbie Yao remembered NC State's glory days in athletics when the basketball team won the 1974 NCAA title, the football program was rolling under Lou Holtz, and the other programs, including the rising women's basketball program under Kay Yao, were strong. So Debbie would ask her sister, "What happened? Why can't State do better?" And she would let me know she was the basketball coach and she didn't have the answers for all the other sports, Debbie Yao recalls. But it always intrigued me. I knew they'd do great things in the 70s, for example. I didn't know what had happened, but I thought there might be an opportunity to return to those days. Kay Yao died from breast cancer in January 2009. The next year, a Yao was back on campus when Debbie became the athletics director in June 2010. A wave of change was on the way. Changing the culture. Yao, who retires in July, brought a personable touch, but also one that was firm and focused on results. She found a department that she felt was underachieving and underfunded. So she put the motto, Wolfpack Unlimited, refused to accept the status quo, on the wall in her office. She removed many of the non-revenue coaches early, and her tenure has been marked by the hiring of 17 head coaches. After the 2011 basketball season, she replaced Sidney Lowe after he went just 25-55 overall in ACC play. After football coach Tom O'Brien's team posted a 7-5 record in 2012, she removed him as well. She said when the decision was announced that she wanted a coach who would bring in Alabama-type talent, a comment that drew some snickers, but Yao's comments and her dramatic moves set a tone of high expectations. But that also requires dollars. One of the beliefs I have is resources have to match expectations, Yao says. That wasn't the case. She notes that the athletics budget was around $46 million when she arrived and is now $86.7 million, although still low by the standards of the NCAA's top programs. We are not outspending anyone, Yao says. We have one of the lowest budgets in the nation. But we overachieve. Our coaches overachieve year in and year out. Taking on the challenge. Challenges were nothing new for Yao, who grew up with two sisters and a brother in modest circumstances in Gibsonville. Her father worked in Greensboro at a cigarette factory and rose to the job of floor foreman. After work, he'd rush to see his children play sports. My mom and dad, neither one had money to go to college, so they both worked long, hard hours, Yao recalls. My dad would do all he could to get to my night games and sit on the sidelines and give me a little coaching, like, she's overplaying to the right, drive to the left, and if I could do that, I could score. She went to East Carolina University, as did Kay, but stayed only 2 years. I had a great 2 years at East Carolina, Yao says. There was a lot of partying and a lot of trips to the beach, but that does not get you a college degree. After leaving ECU, she found part-time jobs and soon realized she was as smart as her supervisors. So she returned to college at Elon University, where Kay was the head coach. When I went to Elon, there was a man named Lamar Bland. He was an English teacher. He was instrumental in my ability to secure an undergraduate degree, Yao recalls. He created the spark. He really made a difference in my life. She became a high school basketball coach and then moved to college, eventually becoming the head coach at three schools, including the University of Florida. But there she shifted it in administration and found her calling. When you're coaching, it's intense. Those relationships are intense and they are impactful, she says. But they are limited. In administration, you get the opportunity to try to help more than one team. And that is where I felt right. I just fit. The right fit at NC State. At NC State, Yao has overseen a resurgence in victories and facilities. Reynolds Coliseum, the revered home of the 1974 and 1983 national champions, has been revamped and now includes a spectacular hall that highlights the Pack's achievements. The football team has a new indoor practice facility. A particular point of pride for Yao is that NC State has seen its place in the National Association of Collegiate Director of Athletics Director's Cup standings rise steadily. Those standings measure the success of athletics programs across the board and are widely seen as a standard for how well the department is doing. The Pack has soared from number 89 in 2010 to number 15 in 2018. Yao always responds to emails from fans and remembers how one graduate told her he only cared about football and men's basketball. I said, okay, but that's not how you develop a culture. You can't have two sports doing really well and the others doing poorly and develop a culture of excellence, she says. But Yao wrote him. She accepted that he had a different view. 8 years later, she says, NC State won the national cheering competition, and the same man emailed her to see if State would get Director's Cup points for that. I was stunned. It made me smile, she says. She told him no, cheerleading did not count toward the standings, but she appreciated that he cared. That rise has given Yao a great sense of satisfaction at a place where a statue commemorates her sister. When we renovated Reynolds and we built a new office suite for women's basketball as well as for volleyball, I did think about her offices that day, Debbie Yao says. She remembered the modest former women's basketball offices and thought about how proud Kay Yao would have been of the new surroundings and the school's success. I never have taken for granted those moments when you looked into Reynolds and see it packed, Yao says. She would have loved all of this, no doubt. Title, Director of Athletics, Birthplace, Greensboro, Family, Sisters, Kay, Deceased, Susan, and Brother Ron, Education, B.A. English, Elon University, Masters, Liberty University. Of what accomplishments from the last year are you the most proud? Our department was tied for first place on the NC State campus as a result of the employee engagement survey responses that measure job satisfaction. We have won 4 ACC championships this school year and still might win additional ones. What is your professional goal 5 years from now? Working to help people and organizations achieve their goals because success begins with the people, whether in a nonprofit or a for-profit enterprise. What is the most difficult obstacle you faced? My world of intercollegiate athletics belonged to men exclusively until the federal law, Title IX, passed in the early 1970s. As a coach and then as an athletics director, I have chosen to work in a non-traditional environment, and there have been challenges along the way, as you would expect. I am blessed to have had these opportunities. To what community, cause, or charity are you most committed? Scholarship support for student athletes at NC State and Elon University, and Christian charities devoted to helping the underprivileged in our society and in other parts of the world. What female business person or leader do you most admire? I admire the work of Nikki Haley, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. If you could change one thing about the Triangle, what would it be? Enhance the road system. Consider mass transit. This is a terrific place to live, and people move here every month. Our infrastructure must catch up. Finish this sentence. Government can help my business or organization only if it allows scholarship support for student athletes to remain tax deductible, because those scholarships often go to first-generation college students, and the degrees change lives for the better. Now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. This master chef is about to cook up a fabulous time. If you're going to Crawford & Son, the popular downtown Raleigh restaurant, during the week of April 8, and want to exchange pleasantries with the owner, executive chef Scott Crawford, during the night, you may want to look at other options. You see, Crawford will not be available the entire week. He will be at the Masters Golf Tournament in Augusta, Georgia. Crawford tells Biz he will be cooking meals for executives and clients of an investment group during the tournament. I have done it for 3 years and I truly have enjoyed the relationship, he says. Biz can only estimate just how much Crawford is being paid for this gig, but to give readers an idea, a six-bedroom mansion could fetch as much as $80,000 during tournament week. Crawford & Son is one of the most successful restaurant ventures in downtown Raleigh, and Crawford says he is thrilled to put the finishing touches on his newest creation, Jolie, a French bistro named after his daughter that sits next to Crawford & Son. Meanwhile, we hope Chef Crawford makes some time to watch one of the greatest sports events every year. Pinehurst positioning itself for more than golfers. Spring means golf is in full swing in North Carolina, but the state's home of golf is looking to expand its appeal. Phil Wurz, the new president and CEO of the Pinehurst, Southern Pines, and Aberdeen Area Convention and Visitors Bureau, recently told TBJ's sister publication, Triad Business Journal, that a fourth brewery will soon be announced and that local Chamber of Commerce leaders have told him two others are planned to follow. Wurz took over in September for Caleb Miles, who led the CVB for 30 years. Miles' term was marked by an explosion of major golfing events, but the appeal of golf is slowing as millennials don't take up the sport. Plus, Wurz said this week, we have to have things at this destination for kids and families to do. This is always going to be a golf draw, but we need to find those other things that will allow this area to grow in a smart way. Golf, of course, remains a major draw with the U.S. Women's Open 2022 and the U.S. Open 2024 ahead. Local schools reap big dollars from basketball. It's no surprise UNC Chapel Hill and Duke University reap millions of dollars in men's basketball. But you might not realize the financial gap between those titans and others in the NCAA tournament. Biz pulled federal reports called the Equity in Athletics Data Analysis for the Sweet 16 schools for the 2017 to 2018 school year. Duke led the way with $36.4 million in revenue for men's basketball. The University of Kentucky was next at $30.7 million, and UNC at $24.7 million. But the gap between those and the others was significant. The University of Houston, for example, brought in just $5.3 million for men's basketball. And even the ACC's Virginia Tech, $13.4 million. University of Virginia, $13.5 million. And Florida State University, $17.3 million were well behind the Triangle juggernauts. Ready to go abroad? Check with some experts first. If you've always dreamed of taking your business overseas and selling your wares on, say, the Champs-Élysées, you may want to consider an upcoming event with the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina. The EDPNC is holding four meetings around the state from April 1 through 4 that will include North Carolina's foreign-based trade representatives. The reps, from Canada to Hong Kong to the Middle East and more, will provide free consultations for export-ready businesses. In the Triangle, the event is April 4 at Wake Tech, and registration in advance with EDPNC is required. Nonprofit group looks to give people a second chance through coding. A nonprofit code school initiative plans to double its operation, thanks in part to a new Research Triangle Park location. Code the Dreams executive director, Dan Rarick, describes the firm's function as like a high-tech TROSA, referring to the Durham nonprofit that offers vocational training programs geared toward helping addicts recover and transition into the job market. In TROSA's case, its residents perform services such as professional packing, moving, and storage. Code the Dream teaches high-tech skills primarily to low-income Triangle residents. It then shops out those skills by partnering with area companies. The entire model starts with free intensive software development training, he says, and then we actually hire those folks who are interested and build up their experience. The demand for what Code the Dream is doing is high, he says. Typically, the firm receives between 50 and 100 applications for just 25 slots, but Rarick hopes to help more people now that its new space is in 4,500 square feet at the Frontier in RTP. Tax filings from 2017 shows the firm received nearly $220,000 in contribution and grants that year and reported just $11,000 in service revenue. That same year, the company paid out more than $151,000 in salaries and other compensation, filings show. And finally, Flight of Hope to help two children get new hearts. Triangle-based Children's Flight of Hope is about to send a pair of three-year-olds on missions for new hearts. On April 7, the two toddlers will board their first flight from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and head to open-heart surgeries at Duke's Children's Hospital. It's a continuation of a mission for Children's Flight of Hope, which began 28 years ago. This month, the company said it had provided nearly 1,000 flights like this one to 65 different medical facilities around the country. Saving more children than ever before, they say. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to On Finance, Tech, and Transportation, written by Lauren Onasorge. Go Triangle, nixes Durham Orange Light Rail. After more than $130 million already spent in local tax dollars, Go Triangle's Durham Orange Light Rail Transit project is being discontinued. It pains me to make this recommendation, Go Triangle General Manager Jeff Mann said before the final trustee vote on the issue. The board voted unanimously to approve a motion read by Ellen Reckow, Durham County Commissioner and Chair of the Go Triangle Trustees, to recommend that the cost-sharing partners discontinue the light rail project as we work together to determine what elements of the project can be repurposed to improve transit in our region. On March 27, its Board of Trustees crowded into a meeting room in Durham to decide its fate, about 2 weeks after Duke University officials said they would not negotiate further with the transit agency on light rail. The trustees evaluated whether to cancel the project, push pause and look for a way to bring it back, or slash costs, which could shorten the 17.7-mile route and cut out NC Central University. The frustration was evident, particularly during a public hearing. Duke doesn't own Durham. The citizens own Durham, resident Waldo Fenner said. And when you gave Duke the power of being the only health system in Durham, you gave Duke the power to control. From 20 years ago to now, you've done this. Correct the problem. The university pulled its support for the $2.5 billion project in February, but that was just one of the issues. The North Carolina Railroad has also not reached an agreement with Go Triangle. Mann said in a recent Washington, D.C. meeting, Federal Transit Administration officials expressed significant concern in Go Triangle's ability to meet deadlines required to get public dollars from the state. The Fed said it was no longer practical that the project would receive federal funding approval by November 30, that the deadline the state had set for its own allocation of $190 million. Trustee and Orange County Commissioner Mark Markopoulos blamed the situation on the North Carolina General Assembly, saying it gave the effort ankle weights and told it to race. But blame was also cast on Duke. I fully believe that if we had a cooperative agreement with Duke University this fall, that we would not be having this discussion today, said Wendy Jacobs, chair of the Durham County Board of Commissioners. To meet timelines, Go Triangle was spending $6 million to $7 million per month in consulting fees, officials said. Utah manufacturer taps Triangle for headquarters. A manufacturer whose waterproofing technology is already featured on big-name products from brands such as Nike, Motorola, and Dell is relocating its headquarters from Salt Lake City to Morrisville, a move that could mean 500 jobs in the next 4 years. Initially, it means Utah's HZO will be relocating 50 jobs to the new Morrisville facility. But we're going to grow dramatically in the next year, says CEO Simone Moraney, predicting 300 employees in 2020, and in 2023, I would say close to 500, he says. The area's rich engineering talent pool won HZO's interest over other locations on the East Coast, he says. HZO develops protective nano coatings aimed at safeguarding and waterproofing electronics, And the rise of the Internet of Things is creating more demand for that mission. Keeping up with that demand requires a tech-centric talent pool, Moraney says. In the next 2 years, there will be more than 30 billion devices in the IoT space, Moraney says, so protecting these devices becomes critical. HZO expects to be fully operational in Raleigh by late summer. RBC CEO weighs ramping up digital strategy. 7 years after Royal Bank of Canada took a $1.6 billion write-down on the sale of its Raleigh-based RBC Bank USA to PNC, its top executive is strategizing new ways to attack the U.S. market, this time through digital banking. The plan could include Raleigh, he told analysts at a recent investor conference. CEO David McKay admitted the bank's retail business can't go head-to-head with mega franchises such as J.P. Morgan and Bank of America in the U.S. We don't even pretend that. We'd even start that journey, he told analysts. What we would envision is taking some of the venture's capabilities and some of the patents that we filed and bundling it into more of a disruptive segment, niche perspectives that would create a broader value chain for a segment of the U.S. population. The bank declined to elaborate on McKay's statements, but McKay included Raleigh in the conversation on stage. We've built on our digital franchise out of Raleigh, North Carolina, he said, and we could put those capabilities on top of that franchise that we already have, we've had for 6 or 7 years now, and we go into the market. Peter Gwaltney, CEO of the North Carolina Bankers Association, says other banks have been successful with a strategy focused on digital. With the right technology and proper compliance and security controls, the strategy is scalable and appeals to digital natives, millennials and others, and traditional bank customers looking for higher yields on certificates of deposit and money market accounts, he says. Marvell Technologies taps Triangle for R&D center. Semiconductor firm Marvell Technology is quietly building a research and development team in the Triangle. The public company, which recently reported fiscal 2019 revenue of $2.9 billion, plans to open a new Mooresville R&D center in April. Right now, the center is a local team of about 40 working from temporary locations, but soon, aided by the demand from the 5G shift, the company could be at up to 150 employees at the new Triangle Research Center, says Rahib Hussain, Executive Vice President and Chief Strategy Officer. We are planning to grow that office at a pretty fast pace, he says. Marvell developed semiconductor solutions mainly focused on infrastructure. We were looking into which are the areas where we have the right talent, he says. We found that the Raleigh area, in fact, has a lot of good talent, has a lot of good universities, so that is why we decided to open this office. And finally, judge sides with former TCAP executives in legislation. Months after Triangle Capital Corporation ceased its existence as a standalone public company, a federal judge has dismissed the consolidated securities litigation filed against the firm and its top executives for failure to state a claim. In a 30-page ruling filed March 7, Judge Louise Flanagan claims the court can't evaluate whether defendant's statements on TCAP's outlook prior to its 2017 stock tanking were in fact false statements designed to encourage investors to provide debt or equity financing to defendant Triangle. The complaint was dismissed without prejudice, with an allowance that the lead plaintiff, LifeWise, could file an amended motion within 21 days. Otherwise, a clerk is directed to close all the consolidated cases. And now we turn to the On Healthcare and Education pages, written by Seth Thomas Gulledge. WakeMed introducing use of drones. Raleigh's WakeMed Health and Hospitals will become the first medical system in the country to transport lab samples via drone, thanks to partnerships with UPS, a drone company, and an aviator-turned-surgeon. WakeMed will develop an unmanned drone logistics system with UPS and MatterNet, a California drone company. The system will begin with one route between WakeMed's main hospital and its central pathology lab, less than a mile away. WakeMed expects to use the first route as a way-finding route to solve integration challenges, but hope to use drones on routes connecting all their hospitals and clinics in the coming years. The first flights will begin within weeks. Financial details were not disclosed. The program is conducted under the Federal Aviation Administration's Unmanned Aircraft System Integration Pilot Program, which partners with the private sector to test integration of the technology into society. WakeMed is the first health system to implement the technology, shepherded by Dr. Stuart Ginn, a former commercial airline pilot who pursued a medical career. Now the medical director of WakeMed Innovations, Ginn says his team began looking at the logistics of moving thousands of delicate samples. There are many small parcels moving around our system for which we pay a lot. The problem was that it is often unpredictable when or where we were going to need to move things, he says. The solution we had was a courier, a human being in a van, which is a great solution in many cases, but you often find couriers driving across town just to grab one tiny lab sample. New urgent care will serve behavioral health concerns. Hospitals often cite a rising concern about behavioral health patients ending up in their emergency department, which can be poorly equipped to deal with the complex care needed for those patients. Now, one provider and Wake County are partnering to open the county's first behavioral health urgent care. This week, Alliance Health and the county announced the development of a behavioral health urgent care center off Chapinoke Road. The center will be operated by Monarch, an Alliance Network providers that also offers outpatient behavioral health services elsewhere in the Triangle. Sean Schreiber, Executive Vice President of Provider Networks and Community Health at Alliance, says the company is hoping to bridge a gap in care for patients that need medical attention more urgently than traditional outpatient providers can offer, but not critical enough for a crisis center or hospital. Let's say you're having some issues, but it has not yet reached the level where you think you might need to be in a bed someplace. You just need to talk to someone today, he says. Durham has lowest doctor compensation in America, new study says. Though the Triangle may be a hotbed for research, innovation, and healthcare, a national study has found one of the area's cities tops a national ranking for the lowest compensation for its doctors. According to the third annual physician compensation report compiled by Doximity, one of the largest professional medical networks in the U.S., Durham has the lowest average salaries for physicians in the country, averaging $266,180 in 2018. The rankings are led by Milwaukee, where physicians averaged $395,363 in 2018. The study also ranked Durham as the second lowest city in the country for female physician pay, reporting they make on average $226,594 per year, substantially lower than the Durham average. Nationally, the study reports a 25.2% gender pay gap between physicians, with female doctors averaging $90,490 less than the average male doctor. Those figures may have some Triangle doctors seeking greener pastures, and they might not have to go far. According to the study, Charlotte ranks fifth in the nation for average salaries, reporting $368,205 on average in 2018, more than $100,000 more per year for the same work, less than 150 miles away. Employees brace for layoffs at large Triangle CRO in Durham. One of the Triangle's largest clinical research organizations is in need of a reorganization which could soon put many employees out of work. This month, the Durham-based Duke Clinical Research Institute began informing its employees that layoffs would be coming before the end of the fiscal year, according to an email from interim executive director Leslie Curtis and obtained by Triangle Business Journal. At this time, I do not expect the reduction to occur before May 1, she stated. I do expect it to happen before June 30, the end of this fiscal year. Company officials confirmed those layoffs are still expected, but declined to elaborate further. DCRI is currently undergoing a comprehensive strategic planning effort that is expected to result in a number of changes, including a reduction in staff, says Mark Slagle, Director of Media Relations. Currently, the company employs 1,300 in the Triangle and occupies two buildings in downtown Durham, the Durham Center and 200 Morris Street. In the same email to staff, Curtis described the difficult situation the company is in, facing challenges squarely based in the changing clinical research environment, our mix of commercial and government business, and a lag in new business at this time. Curtis offered some insight into the company's strategy in the email, offering hope based on insights from our sponsors and partners, information about opportunities where the DCRI can distinguish its services in the near future, and initial ideas for partnerships we could pursue to position the DCRI for the future. And finally, Duke to pay $112.5 million to settle federal allegations. Duke University has agreed to pay $112.5 million to settle a suit with the U.S. government over allegations it submitted false research reports to receive federal dollars. The university reached a settlement over allegations brought forward by whistleblower Joseph Thomas, a former employee, who alleged that during his time working as a lab research analyst in the Pulmonary, Asthma, and Critical Care Division of Duke University Health Systems, the clinical research coordinator, Aaron Potts Kant, manipulated and falsified studies. The case also contends that the university and its Office of Research Support, upon discovering the fraud, concealed it from the government. Duke was accused of submitting claims to the National Institutes of Health and Environmental Protection Agency between 2006 and 2018 that contained false or fabricated data that caused the two agencies to pay out grant funds they otherwise would not have. Those fraudulent submissions, the case claims, netted the university nearly $200 million in federal research funding. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to a page written by Dathan Kazuk on restaurants and retail. D.C.-based Cava, spelled C-A-V-A, opens at Raleigh's Cameron Village. Cava, a fast casual restaurant featuring Mediterranean food, opened its first restaurant in Raleigh on March 26. The new location is located at 403 Daniel Street at Cameron Village and is the first of several new locations opening up in the state. Coming are locations in Chapel Hill, Huntersville, and Charlotte. Cava, based in Washington, D.C., is known for its salads, pitas, and grain bowls. The Raleigh location features 59 seats for dine-in guests, outdoor patio seating, and a pickup area for orders placed online. Cava kicked off its Raleigh opening with a community day for the local area, a tradition the chain has done since opening in 2011. Proceeds went to Sow Much Good to help support healthy communities in underserved neighborhoods. Raleigh Chef once again up for James Beard Award. The awards are continuing to roll in for local leaders in the food and beverage scene, with Ashley Christensen of Raleigh getting a nomination for Outstanding Chef from the James Beard Foundation. Christensen is one of five finalists for the prestigious award. She was named Best Chef in the Southeast in 2014. Meanwhile, Lone Rider Spirits was recently awarded a gold medal by the American Distilling Institute, ADI, for its Sherry Cask Finish Bourbon Whiskey. "We are extremely excited about bringing this medal home," says Chris Milkey, president of Lone Rider Spirits. "Our team is working hard to get this exceptional bourbon to as many ABC stores, bars, and restaurants as possible." Durham Taco Restaurant changes name, not identity. You can expect the same hand-pressed corn tortillas, pickled jalapenos, and mouth-watering tacos Nana Taco has been producing for its patrons, but now with a new name. The modern Mexican eatery is now Nuevo Taco. The eatery has been a Durham institution since Scott Howell and Jennifer Gilley opened it in 2011, but in late 2018, the restaurant transitioned from a partnership to Gilley becoming the sole owner. "I'm excited to continue this legacy with our team and to play our part in Durham's thriving food scene," Gilley said. This transition in ownership has been discussed for years, and while our name is changing, our commitment to quality food and exceptional guest experiences will stay the same. The sale, from Howell to Gilley, continues Howell's trend of nurturing local owners in the thriving Durham restaurant scene. New restaurant fuses Italian food, Japanese flair. You're looking for a bite to eat, but with a twist? How about classic Italian cuisine that incorporates traditional Japanese ingredients? Add to that some 1980s alternative music while you enjoy your meal, and that's what you get at Raleigh's Papa Shogun restaurant at Seaboard Station. Occupying the old Kimbap Cafe site is a new restaurant where owner and chef Tom Cuomo is cooking up fusion dishes such as kombu nochi with mushroom dashi, charred broccoli with 36-month-aged Parmesan Reggiano, and the tonkatsu Milanese, a pan-fried heritage pork chop with a yuzu vinaigrette. Cuomo studied under chef Wiley Dufresne at the New York City restaurant WD50. Dufresne was a James Beard nominee in 2000 and won the James Beard's Best New York City Chef in 2013. Food and Wine magazine named him one of America's 10 best chefs in 2001. Wiley is awesome. He's probably the greatest person I've ever worked for, Cuomo says. Dufresne is known to be an eccentric chef, but became a great mentor for Cuomo. He's weird, but you have to be to do this job, he says. Cuomo states for someone to have the fame that Dufresne had, but was still humble enough to mentor Cuomo was a godsend. I learned from Wiley the way to build the perfect bite, and that was also around my time in getting into fine dining, he says. That detail shows in even the small plates Papa Shogun has to offer. For example, the fresh pulled mozzarella, served with kombu garlic bread, shizo, and tagarashi. The warm cheese pairs well with the crunch of toasted bread. One might not always think of Asian and Italian foods as that perfect fusion, but Cuomo has a perfect analogy. What would you consider American cuisine? We are a giant melting pot, so you can take vegetables from all over the world and flavors from all over the world and put them together and call that American, he says. And finally, in a section called They Said It, we're working on labels right now. We'll be mobile canning and hand bottling. We got a mobile canning company out of Greensboro that does the canning for Haw River, and there's no minimum, so that's good for us because we're small. And that's Dana and Chris Bankston, co-owners of and brewers at Bryce's Brewing, on getting ready to can beer for the first time. And now we turn to the On Real Estate section, written by Cliff Barnes. Report, despite being near capacity, Triangle Mall loses value. A recent report issued shows a well-known Triangle Mall losing value of the property tied to a couple of loans. Designed in the early 2000s to cater to high-end shoppers, Triangle Town Center, located off Capitol Boulevard near Interstate 540, has been plagued by debt for the last several years. 3 months after Triangle Town Center became in default on two loans totaling about $100 million, the value of the mall has fallen again. March data, evaluated by TREPP, a commercial mortgage data tracker, shows that the larger of the loans, $74.6 million, has been assigned an appraisal reduction amount of $23.2 million. Sean Barry, a research analyst at TREPP, says that figure appears light since the most recent valuation on the property earlier this year came in at $43.1 million. The value was reported as $285 million in 2005, but by 2016, that figure was lowered to $150 million. About a third of the mall's 1.4 million square feet is the underlying collateral for the loan. The store owners and employees at the mall have been dealing with the fiscal issue since the borrowers indicated in the fall of 2015 they would not be able to pay off the loan by the original December 2015 maturity date. Several store owners at the time admitted to being nervous about the future of the mall. In early 2016, however, the loan was modified, giving the mall a 3-year term extension with the maturity date moved to December 2018, which ultimately also was not satisfied. While the mall's owners wouldn't discuss the debt, they indicated last month that nothing would change for the stores or customers. That appears to be the case, as the most recent financial records show a strong debt service coverage ratio, or DSCR, of 1.56, which means the owners have 56% more cash flow than is needed to cover debt payments. In addition, the occupancy rate stands at 95%, which, despite losing Sears as an anchor store, is 4% higher than the national average over the fourth quarter of 2018. Kuwaiti entrepreneur jumps into real estate market. A two-building office complex in Northeast Raleigh that houses a Xerox spinoff company has been sold for $14.5 million to a company whose founder and president is an American-educated Kuwaiti entrepreneur. Hamad Al-Homaizi of Milena USA LLC purchased the 8.5-acre tract and complex from Raleigh Portfolio NW LLC, which had purchased it for $10.2 million in 2006. Located at 4924 Green Road, the property is off US 1 and Spring Forest Road. Al-Homaizi, who graduated from George Washington University in 2000 with a degree in computer science and business administration, lists his city of business as Chaldea, which is a suburb of Kuwait City. The buildings were formerly home to Xerox and its affiliated computer services, or ACS. The buildings are two connected structures, each with 55,200 square feet of space. Al-Homaizi is part of a well-known business family in Kuwait, and he has launched several businesses such as I.O. Centers, a successful network of upscale business space, instant offices in Kuwait. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the Editor's Notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Equality, Affordability Should Center Mayoral Race. In the past few days, former Raleigh City Council member Marianne Baldwin and Wake County Board of Commissioners member Caroline Sullivan have joined local attorney Charles Francis in announcing they are running for the mayor's job in Raleigh, following the announcement by Nancy McFarland that she will not seek re-election in October. It is understandable why there is so much interest in managing one of the fastest-growing cities in the country. Raleigh is the largest city in Wake County, a county attracting close to 70 new people every day. The majority of them are looking for living and working options in the capital city, but the numbers are beginning to work against the newcomers. Homes have gotten expensive as compared to prices just 5 years ago. While most people acknowledge Wake County homes are still far cheaper for people relocating from the Northeast or the West Coast, affordability is a definite issue for a region growing so fast. The median home value in Raleigh is about $273,000. In 2012, it was about $200,000. The median listing price of a home in Raleigh currently is about $327,000. And then there is the issue of equality, equal pay, and equal access. For many of us, affordability, inclusion, and equality may seem like buzzwords circulated through the social media culture of outrage, but these issues are real. All one has to do is ask a business owner or a CEO of a company in the Triangle that manages hundreds or thousands of workers. Just this week, the Wake County Economic Development, the corporate recruitment arm of the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce, announced the formation of Triangle Diversity, Equity, Inclusivity Alliance, or DEI, a coalition of business leaders in the Triangle region advancing those causes. The gesture is admirable, but we need results. The candidates running for Raleigh mayor have a unique opportunity to address these issues and should aggressively do so with the help of business and business owners who are willing to make some financial sacrifices to make matters right. Just talking about these issues with a bullhorn in front of like-minded people will not generate results. One has to bring the other side to the table to discuss the path to affordability and equality. After all, any way you look at it, we are talking about money and profits. Millennials must play a critical role in this year's election, and the candidate who is able to lasso support from this vocal and relevant bloc is likely to win the mayoral race. It is hard not to agree with all the candidates who say the city council currently is not functional, and important issues surrounding growth and equality cannot be forwarded because members are distrustful of one another. That has to change, period. That's why a lot is at stake for Raleigh this October. And also on the Viewpoint page, we have a column written by Chris Thomas, who is a partner at Parker Poe's Raleigh office, and Catherine Lawson, who is an associate in Parker Poe's Raleigh office. The headline, SCOTUS ruling could affect business. As Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg recognizes in the first sentence of the U.S. Supreme Court's recent unanimous decision in Fourth Estate Public Benefit Corporation versus WallStreet.com, the Copyright Act compels the prompt registration of copyright claims. The takeaway from this decision is simple and straightforward for industries ranging from software developers and video game designers to textile pattern makers in the Triangle. If you are an owner of copyrightable works, it is more important than ever to quickly and systematically apply to register your copyrights. Registration is not a condition of copyright protection, which begins as soon as an original work of authorship is fixed in a tangible medium of expression. But a registration for a copyrighted work provides certain benefits under the Copyright Act that are not available for unregistered works. In Fourth Estate, the Supreme Court addressed a circuit split over how to interpret the Copyright Act's requirement that registration of the copyright claim has been made before bringing an infringement lawsuit. Around the country, the circuits were divided over whether the law required a person claiming copyright infringement in court to have first completed the registration process, the registration approach, or to have simply applied for a registration, the application approach. It has long been understood that in most cases, applying to register a work prior to the commencement of its infringement is a prerequisite to certain remedies for infringement, including recovery of costs and attorney's fees. In Fourth Estate, the court held that registration is a prerequisite to beginning a lawsuit at all. The court's decision requires copyright claimants to wait to bring an infringement suit until after the Copyright Office has acted on their application. The only exceptions to this requirement are for live broadcasts and for works vulnerable to pre-distribution infringement, for example, movies and musical compositions, which may be pre-registered. And even owners of these categories of works must complete the full registration process promptly following the transmission of a live broadcast or the first publication or infringement of a pre-registered work in order to successfully bring infringement claims. Prompt registration provides copyright owners with many benefits. The owner of a work registered prior to an infringing act or within 3 months of the work's first publication may elect which type of monetary remedy he or she shall receive, statutory damages or actual damages and profits, and is eligible for an award of attorney's fees and costs should he or she prevail in the lawsuit against the infringer. This not only increases the benefit of winning a lawsuit, it incentivizes infringers to cease their unlawful acts upon receipt of a cease and desist letter, sometimes preventing the need to file a lawsuit in the first place. This allows the owners of registered works to be more effective and efficient in their efforts to protect their intellectual property covered by the copyright. Also, registration of a work before or within 5 years of its first publication provides a presumption in litigation that the copyright and facts stated in the certificate are valid. Further, the owner of a registered work may record the registration number with U.S. Customs and Border Protection to help prevent the importation of infringing works from abroad. The bottom line for your organization, whether it is a small business, large company, university, or nonprofit, is the same. Apply to register your copyrights now. It costs $55 to file an electronic application, and the average processing time is 7 months. In the event that you discover an unregistered work you own is being infringed or counterfeited, you may file an application and request special handling, which expedites the processing after submission of a signed statement and the payment of an $800 fee. The benefits of applying to register copyrights before infringement begins have long been clear. In clarifying the necessity of registration before bringing a claim, the Supreme Court's decision further emphasizes these benefits and should encourage owners of copyrighted works to file applications as a matter of course. And now we turn to the Executive Voice column featuring Bill King. Age 33, spouse Jenny, education, bachelor's in history, University of Georgia, master in public administration, University of Georgia, master in city and regional planning, UNC Chapel Hill. First job, I was the information guy at a mall in Atlanta when I was a teenager. I told people where to find the bathrooms and footlocker and for some reason was required to wear all black. And Bill King's article is written by Dane Huffman with the headline, "He helps craft a new vision for the future of downtown." Bill King knows the numbers. For 5 years, his research provided key insights for the Downtown Raleigh Alliance. And when President and CEO Chris Larson announced in February he was taking a job in Los Angeles, the DRA board quickly turned to King. Now it's King's job to see the trends and help guide the city on a path that provides for both growth and the quality of life that makes Raleigh attractive. What are the priorities for downtown ahead? Making sure that all of our small businesses, arts and creative community, and a diverse set of stakeholders are able to thrive in downtown. We do not want to look back and see that we lost everything that makes downtown Raleigh unique. I also want to engage the rapidly growing residential community and make sure they feel heard and a part of downtown. We are also working with partners on ways to increase the opportunities for minority-owned businesses in downtown, while highlighting and supporting our strong base of women-owned businesses here. Public art is a big priority for us, as is changing our events to be more about programming underutilized areas in new ways. What's the biggest change with your new role? I have to own more than 2 suits now, but also I am taking on new responsibilities in management, budgeting, and fundraising, as well as overseeing a larger variety of projects from murals to new activations, and just a lot more meetings to manage. I'm also visiting citizen advisory councils across the city to listen to citizens not just in downtown, but all over to understand their interests and concerns, as well as help them connect with their downtown. What are your biggest concerns? As a region, we are wrestling more with the pros and cons of growth. I want to make sure that as downtown grows, we keep those things unique and interesting about it alive and well, while accommodating more people and becoming a strong urban core. What impact will new grocery stores have on downtown? Our expectation is that it makes downtown Raleigh even easier to live in and reduces the need to use your car to go to the store. In the case of Weaver Street Market, I think they will also help create another third place where people go just to spend time, talk, mingle with the community, and grab a quick meal from the hot bar. And Publix will bring those wonderful subs. What attracted you to planning? I grew up in Atlanta, which is a wonderful city with a distinct culture and a tremendous amount of diversity, but it is also in a region that did not necessarily handle rapid growth as well as it could. So I was attracted to the idea of how high-growth regions and is another way to do it from a spatial perspective. Here in the Triangle, I think part of the answer is to have strong urban cores like downtown Raleigh, where we create density and connect this core to other nodes of density, which allows for more coherent transit systems and unlocks more opportunities for housing and more urban lifestyle we see many families attracted to. What key recommendations do you have as Raleigh grows? There are 2 choices for growth, upward or outward, and the reality is that it will be a mix of both, but how much of a mix is up to our community. There are many great and unique neighborhoods in this city and region that are understandably cautious and concerned about growth. To ease the pressure on those areas and address those concerns, it is important to funnel growth into those areas that want it and can handle it from an infrastructure standpoint. What's something about downtown Raleigh not many people know? Downtown's access to green space is among the best in the country. We measured it last year, and with the purchase of Dix Park, downtown Raleigh soared past the downtowns of many larger cities in terms of central city green space. As you look at key economic indicators, what numbers stand out? We have added over 2,400 residential units in 4 years, and we have absorbed them too. That has fundamentally changed downtown in many ways, including grocery stores. Additionally, office leasing is moving much quicker than it used to, based on the success at the Dillon, One Glenwood, and FNB Tower. Where do you see rents going over the next 2 years? They will continue to grow, but they will not rise rapidly because continued supply helps slow that growth, and we still have over 600 units under construction right now between Peace and FNB Tower. Where do you see downtown Raleigh in 25 years? A dense urban core with more of everything that hopefully still retains its locally owned roots and preserves some of our unique older buildings, and a place where you can live and work without needing to own a car. You were team captain of the University of Georgia's Ultimate Frisbee team. Were you the Herschel Walker of Ultimate Frisbee? No. I was what you would call in baseball a good clubhouse guy, where I was a good teammate and made the right joke or sometimes serious comment at the right time. I did mention to Herschel when I met him that I played Ultimate and he was intrigued. What's something you learned that was meaningful to you? It can only bother you if you allow it to, which is easier said than done, but is another way to say that ultimately you control what you let rattle you and what you don't. You've got degrees from both UNC Chapel Hill and Georgia. Which one is really the first public university? I'm afraid I cannot answer this question. A man divided against his alma maters cannot stand. And in news from around the state, startup brings co-working to Charlotte's legal scene. This is written by Caroline Hudson. A Charlotte entrepreneur is taking what he knows of the legal industry and translating it into a co-working startup. Kevin Pratt, a lawyer who moved to Charlotte in 2015, founded CoLaw last year. CoLaw manages co-working space for small and solo law firms. It's not a new concept overall, Pratt says, but it's new to the Charlotte market. Similar co-working companies in other cities renovate spaces of their own to house attorneys, Pratt says. But CoLaw is taking a different approach in that it instead plans to partner with other co-working companies to manage space for attorneys. So far, the Haig and Industrious co-working operators are on board. CoLaw will launch at Haig's J Street location on April 1 and then expand into the Industrious space at 101 South Tryon later that month. One membership with CoLaw gets you access to multiple co-working locations, Pratt explains. To manage the lease space, CoLaw will install smart resource desk sensors, a type of technology that monitors room activity and schedules times to use a particular space. The idea is to free up solo or small law practices by eliminating significant overhead costs, Pratt says. People are getting much more judicious about how they use space, he says. The problem is it's really, really expensive now. It's much more expensive than it has ever been. And also, there's a lot of pressure in the legal services market in the small firm space because there's a lot more price sensitivity for small business firm clients. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. 832-5138.